King Solomon was a Renaissance man, long before the Renaissance even occurred. He was multi-talented, and he worked tirelessly to become a skilled leader, a diplomat, an architect, and more. In short, Solomon is an inspiration for anyone wishing to broaden their influence. Today on Insight for Living, Chuck Swindoll invites us to examine Solomon's achievements and his trajectory to the top. His success was fueled by a willingness to learn new skills and pursue new goals. So here's the underlying question. Are you ready to tackle something new? Chuck titled today's message, Solomon in Living Color.
Solomon shaped lives and did it in a beautiful manner. He wore two hats so far. He wore the hat of godliness, and wore the hat of intellectualism. He also was quite an administrator and quite an architect. He was a gifted artist with people and with pen. Chapter 5, verse 13, King Solomon levied forced laborers from all Israel. And it numbers them for us right here in line. Verse 17, the king commanded and they quarried great stones, costly stones, to lay the foundation of the house with cut stones. So Solomon's builders and Hiram's builders cut them, prepared the timbers and the stones to build the house. All of this set up as a good administrator would set it up. He put it all in motion. He had a mind for such things. One other thought on his administrative abilities. Chapter 9 of this book, verse 17. He rebuilt an area called Gezer. Areas in the wilderness, 18. I take this to mean sort of an urban renewal project, verse 19. All the storage cities which he had, even the cities for his chariots, for his horsemen, and all that it pleased Solomon to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and all the land under his rule. And it names them for us. As for all the people who were left, now note this, of the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, who were not of the sons of Israel, their descendants, notice verse 22, but Solomon did not make slaves of the sons of Israel. He had a commitment not to enslave the people of God. He enslaved those leftover tribes. But the people of God became his men of war, his servants, his princes, his captains, his chariot commanders, and his horsemen. They were his men, his military force, his administrative cabinet. Very wise administrator, and he didn't fudge in putting the Israelites into forced labor gangs. He refused to do that because he held them in high esteem. Now, chapter 6 is where I want us to be right now. I want to put together a few moments of time on the temple. This is what he became known for more than anything else. Came about in the 480th year after the sons of Israel came out of the land of Egypt. In the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, the month of Ziv, he began to build the house of the Lord. Now, this is an incredible undertaking. This is what David always wanted to build, and the Lord had said, no, that's not for you. I'll save that for your son. And so Solomon stepped into that job. After he set up the administrative system and the governmental taxing and the labor camps and the military forces, then he backed away and said, now I can move into some things I really want to do. I really want to build that temple. And we read that he began to do it. And verse 2 tells us the general sizes of the main worship center. It was not massive. It was 90 feet long, 30 feet wide, and 45 feet high. Just a little spot, 90 feet by 30 feet wide by 45 feet high. And there was a porch, verse 3 tells us, that stuck out another 15 feet out front, but it was as wide, of course, as the building. It wasn't large and didn't take a long time to build it, but it was elegant. It was elegant. See verse 4, for the house he made windows with artistic frames. It's just like Solomon. Don't just frame it in, make it artistic. And so there probably were engravings on this beautiful structure that began to go up. He built it in a certain manner, and while the house was being built, verse 7, look at this. While it was being built, It was built of stone prepared at the quarry, and there was neither hammer nor axe nor any iron tool heard in the house while it was being built. Isn't that something? You know what the workmen sounded like? Listen. There they are at work. What does that mean? Well, it means that those stonemasons didn't have to use their iron tools to chip and break away, because all of that was perfectly quarried there where the stonework was done. Some believe that those stones were dovetailed into one another so that they literally slid into place. Others believe that mortar was used, in fact, but there was no cutting whatever. That's clear from this verse. If you're into construction, only you can appreciate all that that means. Incredible elegance and class. Look at verse 18. There was cedar on the house within, carved in the shape of gourds and open flowers. All was cedar. There was no stone seen. No stone was seen. It was covered with cedar. 22. He overlaid the whole house with gold until all the house was finished. The whole altar, which was by the inner sanctuary, was he overlaid with gold. Also in the inner sanctuary, he made two cherubim of olive wood, each 10 cubits high. And it talks about the shape and the size and the makeup of these cherubim. Verse 28, he overlaid the cherubim with gold. He carved all the walls of the house round about with carved engravings, cherubim and palm trees and open flowers, inner and outer, in the inner and outer sanctuaries. You know why they called it the sanctuary? Because that's where God dwelt. The sanctuary is the place where the living Lord dwells. That's why no building should technically ever be called a sanctuary. We have the name for it because that's what architects call it on the drawings, but the sanctuary is the person sitting here tonight or walking the streets tomorrow in whom God lives. The Christian is the sanctuary. You come to this building and you bring the sanctuaries in coming. We have a gathering of over 1,000 sanctuaries in this place tonight. Now, in those days, God did not live in the child of God. In fact, he was the believer. Did not know the permanent indwelling of God as we do today. And God dwelt in a house, in buildings, where there were these beautiful carvings and this incredible work of engraving. It goes on and on to describe it, and you can read it for yourself in your own study. One historian writes this: Israel experienced a sudden spurt of improvement, standard of living, and economic activity. Solomon was extravagant. He spared no pains to turn his humble capital into a magnificent city. He determined that only the best was good enough for God's house. Basic woods such as cedar and cypress were purchased from Tyre and floated to a port on the coast and then hauled by man up to Jerusalem. Hold your place and look at Ecclesiastes chapter 2. As we're thinking of Solomon the architect, it's easy for us to forget that he was not just a building architect. He was a landscape architect. He was an architect of reservoirs. In fact, he built 3 great pools that are still extant to provide water for the city of Jerusalem. Numerous other projects. Ecclesiastes 2, verse 3. I explored with my mind, this is Solomon, how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly. So he talks about his drifting away in the midst of his prosperity. But verse 4, I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. This was a man of unexcelled genius. And he testifies not in bragging, but just in the fact that he got underway and led out in all of those projects. It's amazing. Now, one more thought. He's been seen as a man of God, as a brilliant composer and author, a scholar, as an architect, and as an artist of the first degree. And an administrator, and now we see him as a diplomat and equestrian. Look at chapter 5 of 1 Kings. He, as all administrators do, stepped into some rather touchy fields of study. One was the relationship between David and Hiram. Chapter 5, verse 1, it required some diplomacy. Hiram, king of Tyre, had always been a friend of David, and Solomon came on the throne, and that was in question. Verse 12 of chapter 5, the Lord gave wisdom to Solomon, just as he promised, and there was peace between Hiram and Solomon, and the two of them made a covenant. Now, the reason I point this out is because that was Solomon's style. He would seek out individuals who were very important to the administration in Israel, and he would make peace with them and sign a covenant of peace, so that this man, in his bilateral dealings with other large and could be vicious nations, he was at peace. That explains how he could be involved in such buildings and such projects. He maintained a diplomatic relationship with other nations. And at first, at least, he did not compromise in his stand. Now, I want you to look at chapter 9, and we'll close with chapter 10. Chapter 9, verse 26. Such unique words of this man, not found of most other people in Scripture. King Solomon built a fleet of ships, Ezion-Geber, which is near Eloth, on the shore of the Red Sea in the land of Edom. The fleet of ships, chapter 9, verse 26. And Hiram, the man with whom he had built up this diplomatic relationship, sent his servants with the fleet. He picked up the knowledge of the maritime trade, sailors who knew the sea, along with servants of Solomon. So they worked in conjunction with one another. And his diplomacy brought in the expertise of Hiram and the sailors, along with Solomon's servants. And they learned together, or Solomon's men learned from Hiram's men. Chapter 10, verse 11. The ships of Hiram, which brought gold from Ophir, and these trees and precious stones, the king made of the trees supports for the house of the Lord. And he got it all to work together. See it? Lyres and harps for the singers. The trees have not come in again, nor have they been seen to this day. It was a unique time in his administration. Verse 22, the king had at sea the ships of Tarshish with the ships of Hiram once every 3 years. The ships of Tarshish came bringing gold and silver, ivory and apes and peacocks. And I take it that Solomon developed the first zoo for the people of Israel to enjoy. In the genius of his mind, he was able to put all of that together. Now, why in the world do we take this time this evening to spell out such detail? Because I want you to see how well-rounded this man of God was. How capable, how broad, how deep. What a pace setter. And along with this, by the way, he was quite a horse trader. I mean that in the right sense. He loved horses. My oldest daughter would just be thrilled to hang around Solomon. She'd think that's the greatest thing, sliced bread. Chapter 10, verse 26, Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen. Look at this. And he had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, and he stationed them in the chariot cities. Remember that. That's important. The chariot cities with the king in Jerusalem. The king made silver as common as stones in Jerusalem. And verse 28, his import of horses was from Egypt, and the king's merchants procured them from Kew for a price. And he had a chariot that was imported from Egypt. It was big on chariots. McNeely's done a good job in his book, First and Second Kings. He writes this about the chariots, very insightful. In Solomon's day, chariots were the most feared of all forces that could be assembled on a battlefield. The speed with which they moved, as well as the advanced weaponry used for their platforms, made them the armored divisions of the ancient world. The tank battles of the Yom Kippur War were modern-day counterparts to the ancient use of chariots. Until Solomon's time, Israel's military force had consisted of infantry only. But Solomon modernized his army by introducing the use of chariots and placing chariot forces strategically throughout the land. Ah, wise of him to do that, protecting the land with this new weaponry. Along with all the fleet of ships and the chariots came the taxation of people that used the waterways, and Solomon owned them. And as they came and as they left and as they brought trade and as export was involved, he dipped over into Africa, the Africa coast, and some of these rich countries around, including the Arab countries. But when you think of Solomon, you think of the man who was wise, but that's only part of the story. He was godly. He was a man of great administrative skills. He was an artist. He was an architect. He was a diplomat. He was a lover of animals, a lover of many studies. Look at chapter 4 of the book of James. I want to close talking about you tonight, and I want to stretch you this evening. Would to God he could raise up and would raise up some who would delve into fields that are beyond your present thought right now. James 4, we often use for a reproof. I want to use it for an encouragement. Verse 13, James 4:13. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we shall go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. It's a picture of a very presumptuous person. Says, I'm going to do this and this and that, and it's going to work like this and that, and I've got it all planned. But applying it now to an individual who does want to count for Christ, verse 14, yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Just a vapor. And instead of all that presumption in verse 13, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. What is the this or that of your life? Before you close your Bible tonight and call it the end of the study, wait a minute. Think, what is your this or that? Now, to be sure, there isn't a Solomon in the place. His mold was broken and destroyed at the end of his life. But just take one field or one contribution that is yours to make. What is that? I often hear those getting a little older saying, it's just too late. You could have seen me 20 years ago, it would have been different, and you could get my attention, but it's too late. It's almost a mockery. That isn't true. It is never too late. I love reading the works of J. Oswald Sanders, and in his book, Robust in Faith, which is now called Spiritual Manpower, he talks about that very subject of never being too late. Canon Nash was who founded the Melbourne Bible Institute and trained 1,000 young men and women for Christian service, retired from his principalship at the age of 70. At 80, he received assurance from the Lord that a further fruitful ministry of 10 years lay ahead of him. This is when he was 80. This assurance was abundantly fulfilled. During those years, he was uniquely blessed in a ministry of Bible teaching to a key group of clergy and laymen, probably the most fruitful years of his life. When he was nearly 90, this author found him completing the reading of Volume 6 of Toynbee's Monumental History as a mental exercise. Like Caleb, he defied the natural order. If you think that's great, listen to this. Man. Benjamin Ryrie retired as a missionary from the China Inland Mission at the age of 70. When he was 80, he decided to learn New Testament Greek. As he had not had the opportunity when he was younger, he became proficient in reading the Greek New Testament. At 90, he attended a refresher course in New... Can you imagine all the guys in class, 18, 19, 20-year-old guys? There's this 90-year-old fella coming in, big New Testament Greek Bible under his arm. At 90, he attended a refresher course in the New Testament Greek at a Toronto Theological Seminary. When he was 100 years old, he was present at a meeting at which the author was speaking. In his pocket was a small, well-worn Greek lexicon, which he used to brush up on Greek while traveling by public transport. It is too late, writes Longfellow. Ah, nothing is too late. Cato learned Greek at 80. Sophocles wrote his grand Oedipus, and Simonides bore off the prize of verse from his compeers, which had each had numbered more than 80 years. And Theophrastus at 80 had begun his Characters of Men. Chaucer at Woodstock with his Nightingales, at 60 wrote the Canterbury Tales. Goethe at Weimar, toiling to the last, completed Faust when 80 years were past. What then shall we sit idly down and say, the night has come, it is no longer day? For age is opportunity no less than youth itself, though in another dress. And as the evening twilight fades away, the sky is filled with stars invisible by day. I think some of you are just about to give up. Surrounded by the young, intimidated by the times, you felt, well, mediocrity will be my best input. Hey, learn a lesson from Solomon this evening. Maybe you don't have all of those gifts, but you have one. You have life. If God were finished, He'd take you. So if you wonder if God is true, when you get home tonight, stand real close to a mirror and go, if something happens on the mirror, then you're still got purpose in life. If nothing happens, call me. Oh, shoot. Well, you're not true till we put you away. And I haven't gotten any calls from you lately, so get at it. Get at it. Take the shackles off. Entertain some possibilities. Pay the price and get at it. And if you're among the young and you've begun to question, should you get at it, there's your answer. Do it. I love Lauren Sandy's words. He said he could take his father's counsel and wrap it up in three words. Get with it. That's my counsel to you. Get with it. Let's bow together. Maybe this is a perfect time to bring a charge to you tonight. Some of you put your minds in neutral and they've been there for a while. The dust has settled and you've thought, well, that's it for me. It's never it till you declare it so. His faithfulness is new every morning. The rising of the sun on Monday morning tells you God is there as a purpose. Maybe to take that course or to step into that new field or to go back for that master's or try that new career or make that move or branch out into that ministry or open your door to the hungry or investing something in your family you've never done before. What is your life? It is a vapor. It appears and vanishes. Father, this evening we've seen ourselves in a mirror of another man's life. It's easy to be intimidated around Solomon. Everything he touched turned to gold. And none of us have known that experience. It's easy to hear the enemy's voice shouting, "You'll fail. It isn't worth it. Just quit. The odds are against you. Nobody's ever done that at your age," on and on. When in reality, you're never finished until life is ended. And then we really have the commencement into what life was all about. I thank you tonight for the encouragement that your word never fails to bring. I remember what Paul has said, "Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How unsearchable are His judgments and unfathomable His ways." Stimulate, strengthen, encourage us. Set us on a new course, Lord. Some who have felt they have been sidelined, get them back on the track in your way with a real burst of encouragement, Father. I ask this through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.
Solomon in Living Color. That's the title Chuck Swindoll assigned to his message today. And there's much more insight about this king that Chuck wants to share with us. So stay with us through Chuck's entire 6-part biographical series. In addition to these classic messages from Chuck, Insight for Living has also prepared a brand new resource for this study in Solomon. Imagine sitting down at your kitchen table with this spiral-bound Bible study workbook open in front of you while you study alongside Chuck Swindoll. It's also the perfect choice for your small group Bible study. This workbook will ignite lively conversation, and it will allow each group member to dig deeper into Solomon's story on their own. To purchase this Searching the Scriptures Bible Study Workbook for Solomon, go to insight.org/workbooks. In addition, Insight for Living has digitally remastered these hallmark sermons from Chuck. It's in a collection of 6 CDs. They're in stock and available today. To purchase the CDs for the study on Solomon, call us at 800-772-8888. In conclusion, we'd like to send you a brand new sermon from Chuck Swindoll in a booklet format. Many have been asking about Chuck's view on leadership succession, and now you can read a biblical response from Chuck. The booklet is called How to Follow a Giant. Just as Solomon stepped into the big sandals of his father David, Joshua was appointed to follow Moses. This transfer of leadership from one generation to the next has all sorts of implications. And in his brand new booklet, Chuck presents a deeply personal message about passing the baton to the next generation of leaders. A copy is yours when you give a donation to support the ministry of Insight for Living. Again, the booklet is called How to Follow a Giant. Here's the address to write to us. It's Insight for Living, Post Office Box 5000, Frisco, Texas, 75034. You can also call us at 800-772-8888 or go online to insight.org/donate. I'm Bill Meyer, inviting you to hear a cautionary message from Chuck Swindoll called The Signs of Erosion, next time on Insight for Living.
The preceding message, Solomon in Living Color, was copyrighted in 1978, 1980, 1982, 1987, 1995, 2008, and 2024. And the sound recording was copyrighted in 2024 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide. Duplication of copyrighted material for commercial use is strictly prohibited.